Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual. And Jim, the good martini is one that I think just about everyone across the political spectrum, at least the vast majority of people, will agree with. And I think most people will expect that that is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. I'm sure most people have heard it, but here's a couple of quick excerpts from some of the most memorable lines towards the end of that address in August of 1963.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
So, Jim, obviously, especially in the recent months and years, there's been political issues that have had racial components, certainly legal issues lately that have. But when people really go back and reflect on what the conditions were actually like in 1963, the dream and how well it was articulated and how much progress there has been since then, it's a day to celebrate.
It is. I was actually struck by a letter to the editor in the Washington Post today where he was going through a restaurant and there was a kid's birthday party going on. And they said they looked around the table and it was a table full of children, black kids, white kids, and all kinds of different, you know, races and ethnicities at the table. And they're all playing and having a really good time. And they observed, you just wouldn't have seen that 50 years ago. Now, it has been 50 years. And you think back to that statement and thankfully, Martin Luther King's children lived in a society they were more often judged by the content of their character than by the color of their skin, but not one that had eliminated that odious component of racism entirely. And I think his grandchildren have done even better. And I think as we look at kids growing up today, as I think of my sons playing with kids of every color and every hue in their public schools and in their daycare centers, I think we're getting closer and closer with each generation. And it's kind of striking when you look at things through the eyes of a child. They don't see color. They don't necessarily, you know, feel that someone being different is a reason to think less of them. Now, kids can be brats. They can be mean, but they're very rarely a result of someone looking different. And it's kind of a striking point about that you have to be taught to hate. So I like to think with each generation, we teach our kids to hate a little bit less. Hopefully someday we will reach that ideal. When we see polling numbers that indicate that people think we're not there, all it takes is one jerk for someone to draw really negative conclusions about a group of people. And that's what you're trying to dispel in this culture. And it's probably going to be a multi-generational struggle. But a lot of good things have happened in the interim of those 50 years. And thankfully, we can keep continuing on this road to progress. And someday King's dream will be indisputably true for every American. Hopefully someday in our lifetimes, Greg.
That'd be great. And like we've said, a lot of progress, some work to be done, but certainly a dream that can be envisioned. A lot of people at the time thought it would be impossible, but it's been proven in the last 50 years that that sort of progress can be made. So great to celebrate that today. Hope all goes well down on the mall. On to martini number two now, Jim, and as wonderful as it is to reflect on King's vision from that day and with the progress that's been made, we do have an economic situation that is still really, really bad. This from the Washington Post today, the number of households with at least one out-of-work parent soared by a third from 2005 to 2011, according to a new U.S. Census report on families and living arrangements. The report paints a vivid picture of how the American household has changed over the recent and more distant past. But one of the most striking statistics was the rapid 33% rise in the number of homes with at least one unemployed parent since before the recession began. It also goes on to talk about single-parent households. More than half of black children, 55%, live in a single-parent household. Among Hispanics, that's 31%, just over 20%. Among whites, 13% for Asians. And no matter how you cut it, those numbers are all too high. But, Jim, when you factor in the economic stress on all of this as well, that's a number that has really jumped by leaps and bounds, but probably isn't much of a surprise.
Yeah, the economic number, the number of parents who are jobless, is depressing but kind of in line with what we would have expected. Particularly when you look at the years selected, 2005, clearly before the recession, 2011, when I think everyone would say that, you know, the recession was still dragging on. The other number that really did jump out, I mean, we knew it had been, you know, close to half, 55% of African-American kids being raised in a single parent household is just absolutely heartbreaking. And we know that for the vast majority of these cases, we're talking about a mother raising her children alone. In many cases, you know, a mother raising boys without having any male role model around. And that's absolutely not only heartbreaking, you can see all kinds of problems coming down the road. Educational problems, criminal problems, drug use problems. I mean, every single indicator, when there's only one parent in there, usually, you know, single parents have it tougher. And when a young man does not have a good role model around him, that generally causes all kinds of problems down the road. If I had a magic wand and could change anything in this country, what high on my list would be elimination of the term baby mama, because the connotation indicates a child connection, but indicates no actual love or commitment whatsoever. And it's really terribly, the term that just keeps coming back to my mind is heartbreaking, to recognize the number of problems that will come out of this, because there are so many kids who don't have both parents in the house. Now, sometimes you have widows and widowers, sometimes you have divorce, but we know that really big number of these cases, it's a matter of the parents not wedding in the first place. Even if you're, you know, not an old fogey like myself who believes that, you know, you should get married and then have kids, they're not cohabitating. There is no father in the house. And you want to offer sympathy and help out the single moms because they have an exceptionally tough job. But I really don't think there's a single social program or a single government program or a single substitute for a dad. Maybe I'm biased by being a dad, you know, telling this to another dad, but I kind of think that they're irreplaceable. And as we look at these societal problems that we have, not having a good, stable force in the household to tell a young man, here's how you be a man. If we could fix that problem, Greg, I have a feeling a lot of other problems would be solved along in that process.
Yeah, I completely agree. Very well stated. And I think not only being fathers, but knowing the value of having good dads, which we've both had, is a great blessing as well. And hats off to the single parents. I mean, they're working hours and hours, sometimes 2-3 jobs a day, just to keep food on the table and the lights on, and they can't be in two places at once. And that's when a lot of the problems start, when they're working so hard to just provide for the kids, and then they're finding friends who are probably not the right friends, and all sorts of other things. And some of them turn out well, but the risk of them not is certainly higher with that number. So very well stated. All right, on to Martini number.
Let's talk about something lighter, like war with Syria.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we talked yesterday about how the Obama administration and unnamed senior officials seem to have no problem giving away every conceivable detail of what is likely to be a brief attack on Syria over the weekend, which is not designed at regime change. But a lot of folks are noticing very similar talking points between the current situation with Syria and what the Bush administration had to say about Iraq. And, of course, the liberals detest Bush because of the path in Iraq, and they have a hard time seeing themselves using the same arguments here. Bruce McQuain over at hotair.com, using quotes from then-Senator Obama and then-Senator Biden. I think they were either talking about Iraq or perhaps a speculation about a possible strike on Iran to stop the nuclear program. And both of them, Jim, just absolutely adamant that unless there's an imminent threat against the United States, that it's perhaps, in Biden's words, even an impeachable offense. So it's interesting what happens when the shoe is on the other foot. And the other issue, you know, congressional authorization. Initially, Bush wasn't going to ask for that. He got all sorts of flack. He then asked for it. He got it. And now you've got Chuck Hagel saying, nah, we don't need that.
Yeah. A couple of rather bizarre aspects to this. One thing is, apparently there's a letter going around to the president that has about a couple dozen Republicans have signed, and maybe a handful of House Democrats have signed, saying, we urge you to come to Congress before taking any military action because you require the Constitution requires you to get congressional authorization in these circumstances. I am appalled at how few people have signed that. My suspicion is that a large number of members of the House and Senate don't want to be on the record, don't want to take responsibility for saying, yes, Mr. President, this is okay, do whatever you have to do in Syria. And the flip side is they don't want to say no to the president in case, you know, heaven forbid, Assad uses more chemical weapons and kills more people. They want to hedge their bets, which is not leadership. And it's not what we sent them to Washington to do. If you think this is a good idea, authorize it. If you think it's a bad idea, don't authorize it.
but don't declare, you know, the aim is not later on to have someone say, well, I actually voted for the war before I voted against it, to quote our current Secretary of State. The aim is to say, look, you know, this is what you get paid to do, to make the hard calls. And I'll be honest, I'm as conflicted as anybody. I think, you know, the use of chemical weapons must have some sort of consequence. But the flip side is, I'm really not sure that these very highly telegraphed cruise missile strikes, at least that's what we're hearing is going to be done, I'm not really sure it's going to make much of a difference or really be much of a deterrent. So there's that aspect. Then there was this, apparently it was in Politico earlier today, some unidentified senior administration official was asked, will the president address the country before taking this military action? And the answer was no. The thinking in the Obama administration is that it's passé.
What?
Yeah, addressing the country before military action. I guess it's out of style, Greg. It's not fashionable anymore. There was none of that in the Vogue's fall preview issue, the same one that said what a dashing, stylish types the Assads were a couple of years ago. I feel like we're in bizarro world here. Up is down and left is right, and everything is kind of reversed because the president is about to go make a very major consequential act, and nobody seems to think it's really all that important to inform the public about it. If and when we do this, who will address the country? Will it? I mean, Biden gave a speech yesterday with his whisper, 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 shout, 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 whisper, 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 shout, 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 cadence, which kind of sort of made the case, but it was a prearranged speech to a veterans group. I mean, if you're going to do this stuff, you should do it properly. And then you look back and you kind of marvel at, for all the grief the Bush administration got in the run-up to the war to Iraq, look, at least they went to the United Nations. At least they went to Congress. At least they addressed the country. I mean, these are all formalities that aren't really necessary anymore. You get the feeling if you loaded up Democrats with a lot of sodium pentothal, they'd say they think this is a terrible idea. But none of them really want to cross the president over this. And boy, that's a reassuring state of affairs, huh?
Well, Jim, you shouldn't have to worry about it because this will be hours, not days. And remember how days, not weeks, turned out into, what, several months in Libya? So I'm sure this will all be mopped up in just a little while.
I'm looking at this and thinking, you know, having looked on Google Maps and seen Assad's palace and looked around Damascus and things like that, Greg, you figure somewhere Assad's got a Rolls Royce or something like that, right? I want to find something that's really important to him and destroy it. And then that'll be our deterrent. And that'll be our signal to him to say, hey, use chemical weapons, you kill hundreds of people. These are the consequences. We'll see what happens in the coming days. Maybe we need some sort of war drum music to take us out here. It's one of those things where we now, with each passing day, it becomes clearer and clearer that almost all of a large chunk of the opposition to the war we saw in 2003 was just rank political opportunism.
I would put in the war drum music as we exit here, Jim, but since I saw one story that said Bashar Assad might not even need to change his dinner plans over the weekend, we'll hold off on that until we actually know what's going on.
I would just tell him, don't take in an opera at the Opera House, which is in between the defense ministry and the state television broadcasting facilities.
Matinee or evening performance? What should he avoid?
Do it early, since I understand nighttime strikes are easier.
Jim, have a great rest of the day. And actually, this is your last day on the podcast for this week. We'll see you on Tuesday. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Charlie Cook of National Review will be in Thursday and Friday. We'll be off Labor Day, but back on Tuesday with Jim. Join us again tomorrow for the next 3 Martini Lunch.